Policy is very democratic these days, or has the potential to be democratic. We all have views as to how the world should be, and it's important that you bring people together and give them a chance to have their say. That leads to fundamentally more robust, resilient societies and probably better policy outcomes.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy, and I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you, your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by Kamil Hussain, Director of Communications and Partnerships at RAND Europe. He has been in the role since July of this year, and he was previously the Commercial Director of Partnerships at Tortoise Media, and before that, Deputy Director of External Relations at Chatham House, where he worked for over a decade in various roles. Kamil, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. Can you just start by talking a bit about your journey to where you are today?
Thanks, John, for having me and for the very broad opening question. I guess my journey as a comms and fundraising slash partnerships professional has been one that's taken about 15 years to bring me to where I am now. My early part of my career was in financial services and doing things that I look back on and don't quite recognize the person I was doing those jobs. But I realized after studying public policy for my master's at UCL in the sort of mid-noughties, that I wanted to work in the area of policy making, either shaping or influencing the discussion around policy. And that's been a continuous thread over the past 15, 16 years of my career. And as a sort of common thread, I think I've always been interested in areas where conversations and consensus can be built through building relationships and bridges between policy actors. Policy used to be, in my mind, something that was the purview of legislators, government departments, you know, those were the levers of influence. But actually, I've realized over the years that it's a much broader ecosystem, and working in the comms field in that ecosystem is a hugely satisfying thing for me, because you understand the different temperatures of the debate. And you can contribute by bringing those people together and contribute your own expertise from the perspective of the organization that you're representing. And I've always enjoyed that.
Yeah. And it's true, isn't it? When you're a child, you kind of think that, firstly, law is this solidified thing that's almost written in stone and unchangeable. And then as you get a bit older, you kind of realize that law is not only fluid, it's also got different people. Even the politicians write the law, but it doesn't really become the law until the judiciary interpret the law and then say, well, we've read this law and it means this to us. And that judiciary is even a jury as well. So even when, you know, the general public decide on something, that suddenly becomes precedent, and that precedent makes law. So it's this constantly evolving thing. And as you say, people like comms professionals are involved in it. And that's why it became very interesting to me when I moved from being a journalist, just writing about what's happening, to moving into public affairs and really trying to work with NGOs and different organizations in saying, well, actually, this law is badly written and should be changed. Or we can see that you're re-looking at these laws and we think this should be included. Which is really valuable. So just tell us a bit more about what RAND does.
So RAND Europe, where I work, is part of the RAND Corporation, which is perhaps quite well known in some quarters because of the work it does in defence and security, which has historically been the purview of the RAND Corporation. And over the years, the 75, 76 years the RAND Corporation has been around, it's diversified its research and policy analysis across a number of other disciplines outside the defense space. Defense is still the biggest, and a lot of the work that RAND does is classified, but we increasingly work on issues relating to science and technology, emerging technologies such as quantum, biotech, and AI, issues that pertain to governance, ethics, regulations of these new kinds of technologies. And we also work in the education, employment and skills space, the criminal justice space, the health and well-being space. It's a really broad profile of policy areas that we are active in. And RAN Europe is just a smaller version of that, given our purview is continental Europe and the United Kingdom, and our client base is geographically within those domains. The way we work is we conduct commissioned research. Our clients are public institutions, government departments, NGOs, academic organizations sometimes, grant-making foundations. Those are the organizations that commission our experts to do the research based on our methodologies and systems analysis. These are strengths of ours, and our work eventually leads to a set of outcomes that we would recommend on the basis of evidence-based research that we've conducted. And these are policy ideas that ultimately are taken forward, or in many cases are taken forward by the client organization. That's our measure of impact and influence. We're really closely collaborating with organizations in the policy space. So that's what we do. We're a not-for-profit, mission-driven organization, and our mission is broad. It's to advance the public good. So the work that we do has to be with a focus on changing societies or facets of society for the better, designing a better health system, or improving outcomes for young kids in the education system, or securing our countries against foreign and malign threats. It's really broad, but it's all intended to deliver a better outcome from a policy point of view than existed prior to our intervention.
Okay. And so really what that means is for those that are kind of skirting around politics, really politicians are pulled in all sorts of directions, aren't they? And they're generally they're an MP, so they've got to be looking after their own constituents' needs one minute, but then also they're being asked to write law that might be on something that they actually don't really know much about at all. And so that's really where experts like you come in, and they have to read these reports and take this advice and all those other things. So that, because even a defense minister, for instance, might have had zero defense experience before becoming a defense minister, and suddenly they're the one saying, well, we're going to do the X, Y, or Z.
Well, decision makers, elected officials, they're reliant on the institution that they have authority over to guide them on the sort of options that are available and the evidence that suggests, option A is perhaps a better path to take than option B. But those ideas need to originate somewhere. They need the sort of bedrock of analysis and research, and they are apolitical. We're not a political organization. We don't have an affiliation with any party or political institution, but our ideas are about people. Politics is a broader principle than who governs our countries. Our work is about evidence and analysis, and our clients are there to take them forward or not. And if the political agenda is favorable, maybe they'll move forward. Perhaps if there's resistance from policymakers, but we are outside of that particular debate. Our job is to deliver evidence-based analysis to our clients. So if it's the if it's the Department for Trade, that's our client. What they do with that and how they advise their minister is their purview, and we're not part of that conversation. And the same in
Lots
other jurisdictions.
of journalists, as a shorthand, talk about many of the research organizations as being think tanks. Would you consider
They
RAN to be a think tank?
do. We don't describe ourselves as that, but the first time the word think tank was applied to an organization was in reference to RAND. I don't know who that was, but that term was coined to describe RAND.
There you
But
go.
we're a research organization. We are a not-for-profit, mission-focused research organization. The people who work at RAND are predominantly researchers. Obviously, they have to have people like myself and my colleagues who are, whose job it is to disseminate our ideas and take what we've done and tell the story to a wider community of participants in order to raise our profile, enhance our reputation, protect our brand and values, and help to grow the business. But most of the people at RAND are researchers and they have multiple disciplines, you know.
Well, there we are. The world's first think tank. Not that you're going to call yourself a think tank, I
No,
know,
no.
but I certainly will, because I always go for a shorthand if I can. So that actually, the world's first brings nicely onto you. You spent 10 years at Chatham House.
I did.
And I can't think of a better bit of PR in the whole world than having everyone sat around any table where they want to make sure that people speak freely around the table, and saying, as they often do, this is under Chatham House rules. And they always say rules. Tell us about, one, your work there, and how the hell did they get that great bit of branding so that suddenly everyone knows about Chatham House through that?
Well, on the rule, as I try not to be too pedantic about reminding people, there is only one rule, the Chatham House rule, and people who work at Chatham House often correct people on social media when we feel a bit peeved. But the rule
Right,
itself, it's
so they should be saying this is Chatham House rule, not plural. Right.
there's only one rule, and if you ever visit the building, it's inscribed in one of the walls outside the library. But ultimately, the Chatham House rule serves as a function, as you say, to foster open dialogue and debate. What it isn't is a off-the-record rule or a Vegas rule. It's a non-attribution rule. The idea is that John, you and I can have a conversation under the Chatham House rule. You can impart ideas and information. I can make use of that. What I can't do is attribute that information back to you. And
Right.
that applies whether it's four people in the meeting, 10 people in the meeting, however many people in the meeting. And it's the rule that fundamentally succeeds because of the spirit of its application. People understand it's quite a, what's the word, a subtle distinction, which is you can use this information. No one is telling you that this information stays in this room, but you have to be
Right.
mindful and responsible in terms of your sourcing, not to attribute it to any one individual who may not wish for that information to be traced back, the provenance of it to be traced back to them. And it's worked because it's supported over the years track two dialogues where during, moments of diplomatic crises, Chatham House has played quite an important role in the background, facilitating discussions between protagonists that have led to breakthroughs. So, for example, if those of us who studied the Cold War, the original Cold War, and détente in the late 70s or early 70s maybe, there were discussions between the Soviets and Europe, the sort of allied partners, that required track two diplomacy, and Chatham House was one of the institutions that was active in organizing those conversations. Partly maybe because it was always seen as an organization that is quite good at getting people to talk. Who came up with this rule? It's probably one of the original diplomats who, after the Paris Peace Conference at the conclusion of the First World War, came back and founded Chatham House, or the British Institute of International Affairs, as it was known then. And their American counterparts went back to the US and founded the Council on Foreign Relations. They probably thought a neat way to have open dialogue is to formalize it in a rule, in a set of language
Right.
that
So
we can say,
it's been around for 100, it's been around for about 100 years. That's in about the 1920s, is it?
since the origination of the Institute. And
Okay.
it's, I think, had three or four maybe revisions to the text, subtle
Oh, has it?
revisions, but
Okay.
the spirit of the
Because I
rule
think
has remained unchanged.
a lot of people are confused about that rule. I know that lots of time people think that as soon as someone says it's Chatham House rules, That means that the discussion doesn't go beyond the room. So thank you for clarifying from Chatham House itself that anything said, it's just a non-attribution rule,
Absolutely.
and those things can just as long as you're not saying who said it,
Yeah.
it can go beyond the walls.
I mean, I didn't just spend 10 years explaining the rule, but there were moments where explaining the rule was quite a common thing. But as you say, I spent 10 years at Chatham House. My responsibilities were predominantly around the events program. I was privileged to lead what is a world-class events program, both designing the content, building the relationships with institutions and organizations to secure speakers, and raising through that events channel the profile of the institute. So over 10 years, I lost count of how many events I was involved in, but I can remember certain highlights of the individuals I got to meet and interact with. It's quite something.
Great. And so just again for people, it is essentially a think tank, isn't it, Chatham House?
Chatham House will probably describe itself more readily as a think tank. Again, it's a research institute, i.e. has a set of research divisions, thematic and regional. It has a really strong events program, and it has a membership. So it's a membership organization as well. You, John, if you wanted to, could apply to become a member of Chatham House, and were you to be approved, you would be able to access their events program, the building, and the benefits of membership. So it's a multi-headed beast. It's not just a research organization or a think tank. It's a slightly
Yeah.
curious thing in that sense.
Great. So you went from there. You then spent a quite short time at Tortoise Media. And for those that don't know, Tortoise Media is a relatively new media organization. It's called Tortoise because it was set up as slow news, as a kind of antidote to the quick fire social media kind of news that's going through, and maybe a bit of an antidote to kind of tabloid news. I think it does brilliant podcasts. I'm
They
currently
do, yeah.
listening. I'm listening to one at the moment called Elon's Spies, which
Oh,
is
yeah. Yeah.
running over a few different series. It's about Elon Musk essentially hiring spies on his own employees and on the guy that saved all those children in
In
Thailand. That
Thailand, yeah.
that he called a pedo guy because he
And then he
said
had
that
to
he could.
pay him, I think, didn't he? Anyway, there was a court case, as far as I
Yeah, but
can recall.
anyway, he sent spies on him to try and back up his absolutely thrown off the wall, made up claim that he was a paedophile, and tried to back that up and found no evidence for it, but spent tens of thousands of pounds on private investigators and stuff to try and back up his made up thing. So interesting listening to that, and they've done very well on that. But just tell us a bit about Tortoise Media and what's interesting about Tortoise Media at the moment for those not very closely following a media news, which I know most of the listeners will be, is the possible takeover of The Observer, Britain's oldest Sunday newspaper, which I think is at least about 200 years old, if not
I think
more.
it's the world's oldest Sunday newspaper. So,
World's oldest Sunday newspaper. So currently owned by The Guardian. And as we speak today, The Guardian have Guardian journalists have gone out on strike, haven't they? So just tell us what your view is of that potential takeover.
Well, I think it's a really interesting story. When I was first alerted to it by some friends of mine who work at The Guardian, they said, "Camille, have you heard? This is, just broken in the newsroom." I can see the rationale for Tortoise Media to become the proprietor of The Observer, and the from my understanding, the conversations I've been able to have with various folks, the strategy that Tortoise have laid out for The Observer, a digital strategy, make a lot of sense in order to secure The Observer's future, because a print-only Sunday newspaper is not its future. But there is a difficult concept, I think, for the Observer journalists, the 60 or 70 people who form that newsroom, which is, how does a small, still loss-making digital startup with a primary focus on audio as its hero medium, have a strategy that is consistent with what the Observer is and what the journalists who work for the Observer cherish. And, the Observer as a Sunday publication, it's strong on features, it's strong on culture, it's strong on sport, without investment in those areas, what sort of future does it have? Yeah, I mean, there's every argument for Tortoise to buy the Observer. Perhaps there are fewer arguments if I worked the Observer, for the Observer to be bought by Tortoise Media. And I think that's where they are. That's why today and tomorrow, it's the first strike. I think 74, 75% of the people who are, who work as journalists, took part in the ballot, and there was a 94, 95% support for the strike. It's pretty overwhelming, the sentiment in the newsroom against this deal.
And you can see what they're, and you can see why, can't you?
I
So
can, yeah.
as a former Tortoise Media employee, and you're saying that, so you're being quite diplomatic in your answer. Would you, I mean, sounds like you'd be on that picket line yourself,
I
if you're
mean,
in that newsroom.
if I was to put myself in the shoes of an Observer journalist, yes, because from their point of view, it makes less sense. It's a fundamental reshaping of what the Observer is if it goes down this path, which it's likely to. I think, let's face it, the Scott Trust is at this stage, and the Guardian, the leadership of the Guardian, there is strong support within the senior leadership for this deal. And I don't really see how things can go back to where they were, that equilibrium that sort of existed. But it's whether Tortoise is the right proprietor. Tortoise has super talented people, and it tells its stories like no other media organization, which is why, with a really small footprint, it's a newsroom of about 50 or 60 people, and relatively modest budgets and size, and it's managed to have what I would say is an outsized impact. But how it can
But it's also completely
swallow the
loss-making, isn't it?
it is, but what it does have is really patient, really supportive, and deep-pocketed investors. But I think the challenge is, how does something like the Observer get swallowed by Tortoise, and what the heck comes out of it afterwards? It will look more like Tortoise than it looks like the Observer. I think that's maybe the simplest way to describe it. And is that something that the Observer journalists want to be a part of? That's
Yeah, and
their
I suppose the other, well, I suppose the other thing is the part of the reason the Guardian is getting rid of the Observer is because it's loss making,
Well,
and then
that's what they say.
to be saved, sold to a loss making organisation doesn't quite add up for why that would
I don't, without sort of without referencing conversations and and sort of really specific discussions that people may have had with me, there would be an argument to say that Observer is not loss making. Some would put that forward, people who are very intimately acquainted with the balance sheet at Guardian Media Group. So it's I don't have that information, and it's not for me to comment on. But
No. Well, I think one of the things as well that's probably not being taken into account is that it was the Guardian that first was the first newspaper out of all of them that decided it would purposely try to go digital first, which meant purposely trying to reduce the sales of its hard copies. It would it would put up its own stories of the next day's paper at about 4 or 5 o'clock the day before, so that every person that bought the Guardian in print edition was buying old news. And I remember them doing that about 10 or 15 years ago, and everyone going, "This is insane." And so there's a good argument for why would anyone buy a physical edition of the Observer when the stories are already there for free on the app or on the website, and they're there earlier. So
Absolutely,
that was a Guardian decision.
and I think the argument of the Observer might be, invest in us, the Scott Trust. You have 1.3 billion in your endowment. if that's not to safeguard the future of the Observer and the Guardian and create a digital pathway to sustainability that recognizes dwindling print sales, and print is not the dynamic way to tell people what's happening in the world. What's stopping the Scott Trust from making that investment? And
Great. So,
again, I'm channeling other people. I'm perhaps I maybe
sure.
share that view, but yeah.
For those that don't know, the Scott Trust is the ultimate owner of the Guardian, and has a quite large amount of money, because the Guardian, as many people know, is run as a charity, and so it's built up that money. There hasn't been profits siphoned out. Let's move on. What's been one of your biggest communications wins over the years?
That's the question I struggle with, because do you remember yours? Do you dwell on successes? I'm not someone who can really recall readily things that have gone
Oh,
tremendously well.
I stand there shining my
Do you?
awards and
Okay.
medals,
Oh,
on a
you know
Friday
what?
night
That
now.
that's a much healthier way to be, John. I think one thing I would say is, during my time at Chatham House, one of the things that we always strived to achieve is, let's make sure this organization, which is quite establishment aligned, i.e. the perception of it, not the reality necessarily, but the perception of it. It's this great big building in St. James's Square. It's called Chatham House. It's, stuff happens inside it that only the select few see and get to take part in. We had a really deliberate strategy over a number of years to expand the community of people who would be able to access Chatham House, both physically and also through the sort of dissemination of Chatham House's ideas. So Chatham House launched a podcast some time ago, and it's gone through a few different iterations. We also expanded the number of young, underrepresented communities who are able to access these events that I mentioned earlier. That to me is a personal source of satisfaction, because I was part of that deliberate cast in the net wider, which is, you have to do the work. You have to find the people who would value that opportunity, would be able to make the most of it, would be able to contribute their own ideas and expertise to a policy discussion that only hitherto a select few people get to have, and they get to stand in the same room with someone who's leading the negotiations at COP for the United Kingdom. Just one example. Now, it's important, I think, for policy debates and policy conversations, to go back to what I was saying earlier, that you find that the points of intervention where you can make change happen. Policy is very democratic these days, or has the potential to be democratic these days. We all have views as to how the world should be. And it's important that, as someone who's more of a bridge builder than a shouter into a very, a specific echo chamber, that you bring people together and give them a chance to have their say, have their voice heard. Because I think that leads to fundamentally more robust, resilient societies and probably better policy outcomes. And
Indeed.
that's an important part of why I do this kind of job. And I think at Chatham House, being able to bring younger, underrepresented voices, not just in the UK, but internationally, into policy events, give them something that they could actually take away, but also give them a chance to contribute, is an ongoing sense of,
And how
satisfaction.
about any time that something hasn't quite landed as you've liked?
This is a bit easier. I was thinking about this the other day. So you will remember back in November 2015, you may remember. So David Cameron delivered a speech at Chatham House. This was the follow-up to his Bloomberg speech, where he announced the terms of the referendum. And at this speech at Chatham House, which I helped organise, he said that he would campaign to remain in. And this was 6 or 7 months before the referendum itself. Now, what then happened within the organisation is, we had a decision to make about how much we, Chatham House, a not-for-profit, non-partisan research organisation, would lean into the debate around the whys and wherefores of leaving or remaining. And we chose to sit that debate out, I would say, because we thought politically it's really difficult for Chatham House to have an institutional view on this. And we can write on this, we can convene on it, but we should probably be mindful of perceptions of bias, campaigning. We were not a campaign organization, and it was a political campaign. In hindsight, my argument would have been, knowing what happened, lead with your beliefs, lead with the things that you think matter. And if that means people think, oh, this organization is really pro-European or pro-multilateralism, well, absolutely. That's the world in which Chatham House was born, countries cooperating, talking to each other, finding common solutions for society. And
But
because we
do you
didn't do
think?
that, it made me feel, in hindsight, at the time I thought it makes sense, who wants all the hassle of being called up by various press officers, But in hindsight, I don't know, perhaps we could have been courageous, more courageous.
That's true, and you might feel, well, I could have done something, and the outcome wasn't the way I wanted. But if we think of who won and the argument they won on, it wasn't that the Remain campaign didn't have a whole host of experts
Yeah, no,
saying we should
absolutely.
vote
No.
this way, and we had Barack Obama, who was extremely popular in the UK, saying Britain will be at the back of the queue, and he was convinced to say Britain will be at the back of the queue.
Yeah.
But then an argument that seemed very effective was Michael Gove going on TV and saying we've all had enough of experts.
Yeah.
So one more expert organisation saying you should all vote in this direction. I'm not sure that would have swayed it, or
Yeah.
even been that useful.
I don't disagree. I don't think Chatham House was the voice that people were crying out for, saying, we won't decide until we've heard from these guys. But it's more about what you feel you need to do. It's sometimes you have to be part of the conversation more overtly, even if you're just another organization saying things where people. And I understand that argument that experts telling people what to do is something that people had felt they'd had enough of because a lot of people made decisions on what is it, June 23rd, June 16th, whatever the date was, born of personal experience, their personal circumstances. That's what people do at the ballot box. How you feel when you do your weekly shopping is much more important than pretty much most other things, like how expensive it is to feed your kids, heat your home, all those things matter. We couldn't have contributed to the debate that would have affected people's sentiments around those things. And I don't think it helps having Barack Obama say, do this or else. Like, who wants to be lectured by the President of the United States, as popular as he was? But that do still doesn't make me feel, I still feel like we could have been more courageous. And that's, just a lesson personally.
Definitely a hard one. Tell us about what media you currently find effective.
Audio, I mean, podcasts. I mean, there's a reason. Podcasts, when I would listen to them in the late noughties, they were usually just silly podcasts, and people would realize this was a really quick and easy way to turn around some content and just publish it. And the proliferation of podcasts and the quality variations are, maybe that's a good thing. You can find something that floats your boat. So I listen to podcasts that keep me engaged. And one I'm listening to right now is Fall of Civilizations. These are long, for like 3.5 hours about the Phoenicians and why they don't exist anymore. For me, it's interesting because it's nothing to do with the day-to-day. I like taking my mind out, putting it into a temporal space that is entirely outside the 21st century, the day-to-day of whatever, I'm doing. And I, you know, I, yeah, and I'm and I studied history, so for me that's interesting. Other mediums, obviously newsletters and short form content. Going back to Tortoise is a success story because what it doesn't do is try to boil the ocean for you. It tells you the few things that you might benefit from knowing, and then you can go away and know more about it. And I think that works given the attention span we have is probably more limited than it's ever been before, and the sources of information we have are proliferate. And as a comms person, you always have to figure out what are your channels, what are your mediums, what are your stories. And the best way to do that is to be the sort of consumer, have the consumer mindset, think about the audience. And as a member of that sort of consumer audience, I maybe have an hour a day to consume information.
I mean, what I'll tend to do, because I have a so half hour cycle into work and back. The morning, I have to do the day's news, so that's the Today program, wound back to 6 a.m. The great thing about the app is you can just whiz it back to 6 a.m. So I'm not listening to the late stuff, which is, not as valuable. But then going back home afterwards, it's great to have one of these podcasts, which is actually about something. I mean, I will tend to listen to news anyway, so that's why I'm listening about Elon Musk and stuff, but I'm listening to something longer form that's far more, detailed and stuff like that. And that's where I really love listening to a podcast, because you've got that half hour, which is a really, as you say, it's a quite decent amount of time
It
these
is,
days to absorb something.
and if you think about the physical behavior when you listen to a podcast, you're listening, your hands, your brain, your legs are free to do other things. You can't say the same if you're watching something, and obviously you can't say the same if you're reading something. So it's actually, it's it's nothing new. We've listened to news since, I don't know, the radio, right? So it makes sense that it's the sort of go-to medium for most people these days.
And I think the other benefit of a podcast is, if you were to be listening to radio all day and you put on whatever your radio show is, you're going to hear the same news over and over again on loop. Whereas you can generally pick up the day's news by doing a half hour listen in the morning and looking at all the right things. And by the evening, you can go deep on things. And so people have to be a bit clever with this, because we're in an information age. You could be completely overloaded, as lots of people do get overloaded with, all the information that's coming in, or you can edit and just think, what am I going to actually get some detailed knowledge of, and what am I just going to be surface on?
Absolutely.
What do you do to unwind?
Well, I have two young children. My daughter's four, my son is one. So
So you've got
I
no
do
time to unwind.
I was gonna say, yeah, you beat me to the punch. I have yeah, I don't unwind because I, as any other person with responsibilities outside of work, whether it's children or caring or what have you, we all have various responsibilities. I don't have that luxury of time that I used to have and probably used to take for granted. But I mean, it's not a chore. It's what I do to unwind is spend time with my kids. And when the weather's better, we have the luxury of having a garden, so I'd like to be out there, try to keep that thing from becoming a jungle. I also have a thing for Lego. I have always had a sort of brain that really just needs to build something and tinker around with something. So since having kids, I've bought lots of Lego. Most of it is mine. My kids don't really play with it. So, but
Nice.
it's an excuse now to spend my hard-earned cash on Lego, which is a lot more expensive than I remember.
Oh, well, I wish I heard beforehand. I've just got rid of huge quantities of Lego, and I've given it to a neighbor, so it's gone to some other child. But Lego is expensive, and I actually during lockdown, I would to decompress a bit, I would get one of those, the big green bottom bits of Lego that you can put
The
other
base,
things on,
base
the
plates.
kind of base. I get a load of bases and I put them together, and then I'd get the standard Lego blocks, and I would design mazes out of Lego that were quite complex mazes, and then I'd be doing 95% of the time would be me, and then I'd tell ask my kids to try and make their way through the maze and stuff. But that was a quite fun thing to do, because making a maze is actually more complicated than you
It
think.
is. And you were doing this in the pa you were doing this in the pandemic.
I was doing it during the pandemic and just making them myself and trying to design one that you can't instantly just look at and see the way through because you're looking from above.
That's a very direct metaphor for how we felt during the pandemic, John. That's interesting.
Camille Hossain, Director of Communications and Partnerships at RAND Europe. Thank you very much indeed. You've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose.